along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, the world needs to hear the truth.
Mavis, everybody. Saturday night, we have returned from the murky depths. Before we get to our guest, let me tell you the guest is first tonight. It's Paul Levy, Dispelling Wetiko, Breaking the Curse of Evil. And we'll be getting into that heavily. But first, I wanted to announce the rest of the guests for February and March. Well, some of March. Next week's guest is going to be, actually two guests. The first hour is going to be Tessa B. Dick. She's a Philip K. Dick. She was married to Philip K. Dick, the sci-fi guru, genius of Blade Runner and, Minority Report and Total Recall and, all that stuff. She's got a book called Fallen Angels, and it's about the Archons and the Aeons and some strange extraterrestrial sci-fi. So she's going to be talking about that the first hour. And I'm also going to be introducing another co-host to our lineup, Michael Jagers. He went to high school with me, actually, and he's a horror film fanatic. He's a co-host on another show about zombies. I think it's called Zombie Cast. But we're still going to keep, we still have Beazle and Jerry helping out and Michael. So three different co-hosts. That way we'll have a wide variety of personalities help out with the show. But he also is in the horror scene heavily, and he's interviewed Sid Haig, you know, the Captain Spaulding from House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Rejects and all. He was in a Spider Baby. A bunch of people just from horror movies. And he's also played a zombie on Walking Dead. So he's going to talk about hanging out with the cast of The Walking Dead for the second hour, which I like the Walking Dead TV show. So, and plus it'll just be funny because he plays a zombie on that show. So that should be interesting. But he's going to be helping the co-host with Tessa and some future shows. That's on the 9th. On the 16th, Brad and Sherry Steger. They're going to be discussing their book, Four-Leg Miracles, which is basically, trying to find it here. It's stories about dogs. Yeah, Four-Leg Miracles. Heartwarming tales of lost dogs' journeys home. Basically, these, and it says, funny, heartbreaking, will make dog lovers of all ages smile. From Publishers Weekly, a blurb. These stories, I guess, about how dogs overcame obstacles like natural disasters, fierce wilderness areas, predators, grievous injuries, emotional distress, and they come home. So it's like one of those Lassie come home stories. They're going to be telling different stories about that. A heartwarming show with Brad and Sherry. It'll be the first time they've been on the show. And, of course, I've interviewed him on Examiner several times. And then on the 23rd is Micah Hanks. We'll be talking about the UFO singularity. Micah's a good friend of mine, so that'll be a good show. He's been on the show, God, four or five times. And then for March, I'll go over that quickly. Let me scroll down here. Jim Mars on March 2nd. I can't wait for that. Occulted History. Are the elites concealing ancient aliens? And Jerry's going to help out with that, Jerry Avalos. And then I'll just read the guest quickly for March, and we'll start up. John Roberts on his book, Secret of the Reptilians, and we're going to get into his new other book with Dr. Ward about Egypt. On the 16th, Artie Sixkiller. She's wrote a beautiful book about Native American stories and their interactions with the Star People. Audrey Starborn, another contactee. And then on the 30th, Christopher Noel about Bigfoot. And he just had a new book come out called Sasquatch Rising, 2013, Dead Giants Tell No Tales. And he's working on a book which I'm going to be in called, where is it? How Sasquatch Matters, Writers Respond to the New Natural Order. He's a supporter of the Melba Ketchum DNA situation that's occurred with basically proving that Sasquatch exists. That just happened. There's a lot of controversy about that. Also, what else? I just posted up a new interview with Nick Redfern about his book, Monster Diary from Anomalist Books. You can find that in the Church of Mavis radio show group. It just got reposted at bigfoots@blogspot.com. And big debate about cryptozoology and the paranormal, and a lot of people don't like to mix the two. So that interview has caused a lot of controversy, which I love controversy, so that's a good thing. But that's for March. So just a rundown of our schedule. We have some great guests coming, unique perspectives, and we're going to have a great time. So I guess that's it on the announcements. Let's get to our guests, because I want to spend as much time as possible with our guests. Paul, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you.
All right.
I'm really excited to be here.
Great to have you. And I guess basically, first, if you could give us a little bit of background about yourself, and then we'll delve into your book.
Sure. Okay. Well, so I'm someone who, in the early 80s, 1981, had a life-transforming spiritual awakening that almost killed me. And it wound me up getting thrown in hospitals, in mental hospitals, and continually given diagnoses that I was mentally ill, which, from my point of view, was crazy, because my subjective experience was that I was recognizing that we were having a mass shared dream, and I was experiencing, you know, that I was waking up to that and in that. And so it was a very difficult time. During that first year, maybe four or five times, I got thrown in mental hospitals and given this diagnosis of being bipolar or whatever, which I was reflecting back to the doctors that was totally not true. And, you know, the fact that I was disagreeing confirmed to them that I was mentally ill. So it was kind of my introduction to a whole nother, whatever, this world that seemed to be a parallel world right alongside the normal consensus reality, because stuff began happening in my life that was physically impossible, or so I had been taught, to happen in the third dimension, but it was happening on this fist. And concurrent with getting thrown in hospitals, I was getting to meet some of the greatest of the enlightened beings of on the planet, from Tibet and Burma, who were becoming my teachers, and I'm still really, really close with, and they're like family. And so basically it was like my experience was that the whole world I was in was split in two, in the sense that on one hand there was deep suffering that I was experiencing, which was actually the source of the awakening, because I had gone so into, you know, my own psyche as a way of dealing and trying to deal with my suffering. And on the other hand, there was this whole other world that I was getting introduced to that was very much like a dream, where stuff was happening, like I was saying, that was not supposed to be happening. And so I was really fortunate in that I was able to very quickly get myself out of the whole psychiatric community and continue my awakening. And but it was very, very difficult time. And it took me about a decade of really working on myself and integrating what I was being shown, and, you know, just expressing myself creatively and studying and meditating and dreaming and all these things, until I realized, oh, well, I discovered something in myself that would be of benefit for people. So that's when I, in the maybe 93 or so, that's when I began teaching and giving lectures and facilitating groups and helping people, and I developed a creative way of getting across to people to show people how we're actually dreaming and how they can recognize that and begin to wake up in that.
Gotcha. And when it comes to your book, The Spell in Wetiko, can you get into what drove you to use Wetiko, which I've been studying up on, which pretty much is a Wendigo, correct?
Yeah. That's just a different tradition's word for Wetiko. They're exactly the same. And what was happening, you see, one way of really articulating what was the source of my experience of awakening was that I was having a direct encounter with evil, but not just personal evil, but really this archetypal evil, and it came through my father. He was a very sick man. But what was interesting for me was realizing, oh my God, the whole family system, in other words, with my mother, and then with the friends, and then even the mental health system, that everyone was configuring to protect the abuser. And it was the introduction that I was beginning to have to the non-local field, that there is this field of consciousness that pervades and underlies the third dimensional reality, and this was how I was first becoming introduced to it. And so once I began to see that, then I began to realize, wow, there's like this psychospiritual disease of the soul that pervades the collective unconscious itself that we all potentially have. And the indigenous people call this Wetiko. And I had given it a different name in one of my earlier books, but I was attracted to the word Wetiko because it, you know, it had a certain power to it. And the source of this illness is the human psyche. And it operates through the unconscious, through the parts of us that don't see, that have like blind spots. We all have a blind spot. That's the channel through which, in a way, this virus of the mind, it operates such that it compels us, when we get unwittingly taken over by it, to act it out in the world while simultaneously hiding itself from being seen. So what the book is about is really creating a map and articulating how this works. And it's actually the very, you know, you could say entity or energy that's underlying and informing all of the evil that's playing out, not just individually in our own selves and not just interpersonally in our relationships, but in a collective fashion. It's actually informing and giving shape to all of the evil that's playing out in the greater body politic. And so that's why I wrote the book, to really flood light on that, because when this bug is seen, when you see this psychic germ, it takes away its power, and it concurrently empowers you.
So, I mean, we definitely can see that humanity's got a sickness from war to just watch the news. So, like right now, there's a guy near where I live in Alabama that has that kid hostage.
The 5-year-old kid, right, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, every day there's a new story about someone going crazy. So I definitely believe we're afflicted. And from my own experience, I've never done anything that crazy, of course, but I definitely suffer from things like addiction and mood swings and stuff like that. But I definitely know where you're coming from with, you know, having, I guess, a spiritual awakening and a breakdown. Because when I was younger, I guess that's when I was around 17, testicular cancer, went through chemo. I'm healed now, but my dad died in a divorce. All that hit me at once, and I went nuts and had an awakening, what I call kind of like a shamanic death, and I started having all these strange paranormal experiences. So I can relate to that most definitely. But the Wendigo or the Wetiko is kind of like this cannibalistic evil spirit or a being that possesses human beings. I think the first time I ever came across Wendigo was that movie with Robert Carlyle, Ravenous, where they're like in the Civil War and they're all out in the snow trapped without food and they all start eating each other or something like that. It was a great movie. But
right.
I, that's the first time I ever came across the Wendigo, I believe.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Yeah,
so the thing is, okay, I'm sorry, did you have a question that you were going to ask her?
Well, I just wanted to get your interpretation of the Wendigo and the Native American view on it, like the mythology behind it and everything.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I talk about that in my book, in that it is like a cannibal spirit in the sense that it takes from the world or from the environment or from other people without giving anything back, and it actually consumes people's soul. So, and you know, one way to think of it, it's like when we get a tapeworm in our system, and the tapeworm then will secrete chemicals in us such that we begin to crave food that feeds the tapeworm. So it grows bigger, and we're the host, and it eventually kills us. But it doesn't want to kill us too soon, or else it would then, you know, have the inconvenience of having to find a new host. And so, you know, it's very much, now the Native Americans were tracking this in their mythology. It, you know, it typically would be in the winter where there wasn't a lot of food and there, you know, people were just, you know, there was lots of darkness and they were alone and, you know, just in their own heads. And their mythologies were like, oh, there's this creature that would take you over. But I'm pointing out that that's symbolic, that when you read that from the psychological point of view, it's pointing at that, yeah, we all have in ourselves the potentiality based on our proclivity for excess or for acting out our unconscious, you know, in a certain way that feeds habitual patterns or addictive behaviors, that then opens up the door for this entity or energy to, in a sense, you know, come into us and take us over. And but it's important to understand, it's not like there's an actually, from the point of view, that there's an actually existing, an objectively existing, like, virus or entity called Wetiko, because when you really inquire into it, like I did in my, like, you know, in my book, you discover, oh, it actually doesn't have any intrinsic objective existence at all, and yet it can destroy our species. And that's pointing at something. That's pointing at the unbelievable power that we have in our own minds and hearts that we're not aware of. And to the extent we're not aware of it, this entity actually, you know, accesses our own creative genius for how we actually can create our lives, but it turns it against us in such a way that we are destroying ourselves. Okay, so the point is, encoded in the Wetiko virus is an unbelievably creative spirit. And actually what I discovered in my book is that encoded and hidden in the virus is its own medicine and is a form of blessing, that it's actually helping us to wake up to who we are, and to wake up to the dreamlike nature, okay?
Okay, I wanted to have you allow on the Dracula dream, and then I want to allow Jerry to ask you some questions. But you've compared it to a vampiric energy, and I know there was at the beginning, I guess, of your awakening and everything, you had some sort of dream with Dracula in it or something like that.
No, that's definitely true. I've had a number of dreams with Dracula. It seems I have some sort of karma or a fate or something. So I've had a number of dreams of that, and one of the dreams, which I want to tell, is that there was an incredible dream I had the morning that two of my spiritual teachers were coming to visit me, and so that morning I got propelled awake by this incredible dream, and the dream was that I was, me and a number of people were trying to find Dracula. We were all on the lookout for Dracula, and we were actually chanting Bela Lugosi, all together like some sort of mantra in the dream. And then I see Dracula. I see him and I point him out to all the other people in the dream, and no one else can see him. And that dream, I just want to point out, that's really kind of informed this very book that I've written, because over the course of time, I've developed a way better fluency and an ability to articulate and to point out this vampiric entity called Watiko in a way that I'm actually able to help other people to see it. Now, the thing about a vampire, because it is totally like a vampire, the Watiko bug, when you think about it, when you get bit by a vampire, you actually become a vampire, and then, you know, you actually transmit you at a certain point you feel so overwhelmed that you have a compulsion to transmit the virus, you know, to someone else. And, I had this dream that I talk about in the introduction of the book where I was actually a whole number of dreams I've had, but one in particular where I was in bed with Dracula. Talk about being in bed with evil. And I saw that he was this dangerous vampire and he wanted me. And I just had to get through till dawn. And then I just, all of a sudden, I'm a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, and I began doing this particular mantra that's invoking the true nature state, but the particular deity is an exorcist and an alchemist. And so it was, and as I was doing this mantra in the dream, it was very painful for Dracula, and he was shrinking and getting his power taken away. And then at a certain point, the mantra changed to the mantra of compassion. Om Mani Padme Hung is the mantra in Buddhism. And the dream just went on, and I was recognizing I was dreaming as I was chanting these mantras, and here's this vampire who's just shrinking and shrinking. And when I woke up, and then as I've written the book, I realized, oh, that was a perfect, in a way, symbol of this living symbol of Tico, like actually, any sort of a vampire.
That's interesting. Also, just to note, I have a Bela Lugosi Dracula tattoo that takes up my whole right arm. I got when I was crazy after my dad died and on drugs, and that was like one of my first tattoos. I've always had some weird Dracula thing. Any book on Vlad the Impaler or Dracula fiction. And it was weird because after I came back to high school in 12th grade from being healed from testicular cancer, I was bald and real pale, and everyone called me Vampire. And during chemo, I read all these Anne Rice books, and I held on to that imagery of immortality and the vampire I guess it was my escape mechanism to read that stuff when I was dying, going through chemo, because the cancer spread to my stomach and lungs. But I've always had a weird Dracula thing, and I'm not the type of person that goes around saying, oh, I'm a vampire, I crap bats, I'm so goth, or anything like that. I've just had this weird interest in it, but that's the main reason I wanted to hear that story. And when you said
the thing I should say, too, is why I'm interested in this is because, unwittingly, my father, was totally unconsciously taken over by Watiko, and in a sense, he was, in a way, kind of like this vampiric figure. So that's why in my own personal life I've had to come to terms with what is the meaning of this figure and how do you engage with it in a way that you're not just going to get destroyed. So I've been forced to come to terms with that in my own life.
Wow, I can relate to that, definitely, no doubt about it. All right, Jerry, you there? Yeah, shoot, buddy.
Awesome, thank you. As I just add to the Dracula synchronicity, because in my studio here I have a Bela Lugosi Dracula movie poster, like a vintage, you know, reprint one, sitting here, so it's like, oh, hey, cameo. But anyway, actually, one of the things that caught my attention in the beginning, when they gave me an intro, you said that after this experience that you had, it kind of shifted your perception. You said that you're having, quote unquote, like dreamlike experiences that, you know, the people in the medical profession just, you know, poo-pooed or whatever. What were some of those experiences that you felt were kind of, you know, blurring that line of reality?
Sure. Well, I can share maybe the first, because there were so many experiences, and a lot of them, I just, you know, I don't feel comfortable sharing. It's really clear that they're not for, you know, public consumption,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And all that. But I can share the first of them, because it was really the portal through which I went into a different universe, and I've never returned. And what it was, so I was, you know, I had this incredible wound and trauma from my father that was so overwhelmingly painful. The only thing that I found that I could do was to just really sit in and to watch what was happening, just which is meditation, because I quickly figured my way out that I couldn't figure my way. I figured out that I couldn't figure my way out of my suffering with my mind, so I just began to watch. And then almost 2 years of doing this, hours and hours and hours a day, because it was the only thing that made me even feel a little bit better. And then I got hit by a bolt of lightning, but not from the sky, but inside, you know, the sky of my own mind, in my brain, a lightning bolt just ignited, and just spontaneously for a nanosecond. And I didn't realize that, oh, in a lot of mythologies, they talk about getting hit by lightning as, you know, in the spiritual awakening. So within a day, within 24 hours, I began acting so incredibly unlike my ordinary conditioned self. I went into this ecstatic state, and I was recognizing that we were having a mass shared dream. And I was living, you know, in the Bay Area, and a friend of mine from the East Coast, which is where I'm originally from, was visiting. He thought I was having a psychotic break, so he brought me to a hospital. And we're in an ambulance being brought to Highland Hospital in Oakland, California. This is May 1981, and it's at nighttime. They bring me into the psych ward, and in the very first room, they bring me into where all the other psych patients are, and I see this woman, and she's blind, and her eyes are totally opaque, and she can't see. It's just really clear, and I didn't even think about what to do. I just literally found myself. I just went up to her. And it was like I was given a script to say this. All of a sudden, these words fell into my head, and I began saying, all you have to do to see is open your eyes and look. And I'm staring at her eyes, and I just keep on saying those words over and over, and I keep on getting closer to her. The whole thing took, you know, not even a, and she regained her sight. And then, as if it was choreographed, you know, the attendants and the doctor came, and they took me and they strapped me up on a bed in another room, which is where I spent the night. Now, at that point, I knew I was having a spiritual awakening. And to make a long story short, they untied me that next morning, and they put me in a room. And I'm sitting at a, you know, table, and I'm sitting on a chair, and the only other person in the room is this ex-blind woman. And she's sitting right across from me, and she's smiling from ear to ear. And all of a sudden, and I never had this before, my heart chakra just blossomed. And then I understood, oh, I get it. Her eyes were physically fine, but inwardly, like in her psyche, she wasn't letting herself look. And somehow I somehow saw that, and it was the time in her process that she was ready to heal. And I was almost the one that, you know, you could say was sent by, like, you know, central casting to play my role and to say my lines. And like I did, and then I had that understanding, and then she says to me, the only word she ever said to me, she goes, aren't you going to answer the phone call from, and she mentions mother's name. And then within seconds, the nurse comes in the room and says, Paul, your father's on the phone, because my parents had just found out I had supposedly had a psychotic break. And so that was the initial experience. I got out of that hospital after 3 days, because the doctor really impressed upon me that he was going to keep me there for a really long time unless I could prove to him that I wasn't crazy. So I completely stepped into my normal, ordinary identity pattern and just began talking about my problems and about, you know, whatever. and he let me out. And we got together for lunch, the doctor and I, the next week, and he told me the fact that I was able to do that, that I was able to be fluid and connect with just, you know, being like a normal person, or at least on a, the way it appeared, that showed him that I wasn't crazy. And I told him about what happened with the blind woman, but he got very uncomfortable and, you know, cited patient confidentiality, and he wasn't able to tell you, he didn't want to talk about it. And then from that point on, you know, I was living in a totally different world. Within a few days, I was sitting at the feet of the greatest enlightened being from Burma, who had just arrived in the Bay Area. He was an 85-year-old Master Amos, who is considered to be, you know, the, you know, whatever, just great enlightened being of that whole tradition. And I got his blessings, and my life has never been the same. It was like I had stepped through a portal at that point.
Wow, that's very intriguing. And considering you said that this is one part of the experience, I can only imagine how much of a shock to really the entire system it must have been.
Oh, yeah, it was a shock to everyone, you know, to me, to everyone involved. And of course, when I talked about it, very few people really, you know, knew what to make of it, and they just assumed I was hallucinating.
Yeah, I can imagine. So easier that way, it seems. And it's unfortunate for so many who kind of believe that, you know, and just take those pills.
Right.
One of the things that I was wondering, too, just kind of bridging a little bit from the vampire discussion, too, is that, would things like the concept of energy vampires be something similar, like people who kind of drain your energy or your time or whatever? Would that be a characteristic of this kind of disease?
Totally, totally. The idea of, like, when you hear about Watiko being like a vampire, don't think of, you know, like a vampire like in the movies with, like, you know, a black cloak and fangs and all that, because we're talking about, like, these vampires that are basically these energy psychic vampires. Where, like, when you think about it, you know, certain people you hung out with and you feel really filled up with after, you feel really inspired, but that's different. Other people you hung out with and you feel drained, like they've just taken something from you, or your energy is, like, you know, just sort of, you know, way lower than at the beginning. That's an example that there's something, because, you know, we all affect each other. We're, in the sense that, particularly through the unconscious and through the psyche, and particularly because we're not separate, we're interdependent and interconnected. So, yeah, one of the ways that the Watiko, you know, sort of bug, it operates, is through the relationship channel. And, yeah, so that's definitely related to Watiko.
Wow. You're reminding me, I was just reading a Stephen King interview. He's doing a sequel to The Shining. It comes out in September this year, called Dr. Sleep, and it's got Danny in it from, you know, The Shining, little boy. But the whole story revolves around this cult of psychic vampires called the Knot or something. And I was just thinking about that. I was just reading that interview. But the whole The Shining sequel centers around a cult of psychic vampires. Another story that I had just read, too, I don't know if this is propaganda from the media or whatever, but there's a story in North Korea where there certain parts of their wherever, a city or something, that are starving and they're eating their children. And I just read that somewhere, and I don't know how true it is. It could be America propaganda, you know, to stir up the war machine or whatever. But I just read somewhere that there was people were so you know, had no food, and they were pretty much it was a pretty big news source that they were eating their kids there. But who knows if that's true or not? But it probably is. I don't know. But there's all kinds of weird, like just over the. Last summer, I mean, we had that whole weird cannibal outbreak of crazy people going nuts and eating people. Like, I did an article of every story of that to keep up with it, and it was just insane. There was like 20 stories of people just snapping and eating. It was really weird. But I guess my main question is, I'm someone that's always kind of struggled with the dark side, and luckily I've never gotten in trouble with it. I've always been in it artistically on some level with writing or reading horror fiction or watching horror movies. I haven't been in a fist fight since high school, so I luckily haven't manifested my dark side in a terrible way to land me in prison. Mostly it's been self-medicating to get rid of it or something stupid like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of curious to the anecdotal side, like what's the cure to this psycho-spiritual disease? I mean, what is the cure to it for humanity and people going through it?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and you know, that's also you see, the thing about this topic is that it's not even when people ask me what is Watiko, I kind of always struggle with what to say, because it's not a topic that will lend itself to language very easily. And but the way into answering your question is, well, okay, the thing about Watiko is that it is like this virus of the mind, like a vampire, like a parasite of the psyche, and like we were saying before, like a tapeworm. It operates through the psyche. Its source is the psyche. The origin of it is the psyche, and yet the tool that we're investigating it with is also the psyche. So that itself creates real problems in the sense that, you know, we have to really think. And so the idea being that because it operates through the unconscious, once we begin to add consciousness to how it operates through the psyche, and particularly its non-local aspect. So one example would be what you were just describing around all the cannibalistic, you know, these actual kind of experiences that you were tracking last year. One of the things about Watiko, its origin is the psyche, but it actually plays itself out through the medium, not only of the inner psyche, but non-locally plays itself out through the medium of the outside world, synchronistically, like a dream, where the outer and the inner reflect each other. Okay? So in other words, you begin to realize, oh wow, whatever's playing out in the world is somehow reflecting symbolically what's going on inside of our psyche. So when we see evil, for example, getting played out in the greater body politic in whatever way, whether it's through these experiences of cannibalism or the Sandy Hook shooting or the war, there are endless examples, you actually can find that, wow, what's playing out, it's like I'm looking in some sort of, like, this mirror. And etymologically, the word mirror is the holder of the shadow. That's what the word actually means. And so when you begin to correlate, to synchronistically discover, wow, it's a non-local disease that's actually, you know, seen in a way configuring seemingly external events to express itself, and it's actually correlating to a process that's happening inside of my psyche, then all of a sudden you're beginning to see the non-local field, you're beginning to see the actual dreamlike nature of reality. And when you see that, you begin to realize, oh my God, I and all of us don't exist as isolated, skin-encapsulated egos who are separate from each other, but we actually are interconnected and interdependent. So all of a sudden, you're beginning to have an expansion of consciousness as you're beginning to see how the Watiko bug operates both in your psyche, and it operates in your psyche through not just your blind spots, but when you react, unconsciously react to something. Then all of a sudden, you become, that reaction becomes the channel for the bug to insinuate itself really kind of into yourself, and you become the conduit for it to incarnate itself in the world. And this gets to the answer to your original question of what do we do, or what is the solution? Because when you add awareness to this bug, and the same thing in any fairytology, when you find the name of the demon, all of a sudden, you know, and it has to be the right name, it can't just be any name, when you find the proper name, the right name for the demon, like Watiko, it takes away its power, okay? So the thing I'm saying, I'm actually drawing a map, and in the book I'm really showing how it operates synchronistically through the world, in our psyche, the two are correlated. And then it'll snap you out of the identification of imagining that we exist as an alien, isolated, separate self. And all of a sudden you realize, wow, I'm actually interconnected with the whole universe, with everyone. And the expression of that realization is compassion. And that's really the Watiko dissolver par excellence, is real genuine compassion. But compassion isn't necessarily like all smiley-faced and let's pat each other on the back and tell each other we're so beautiful. You know, oftentimes with authentic compassion, it can be really fierce and say no and set a boundary. You know, it's not just like some traditions call it, there's idiot compassion. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about real authentic compassion that sometimes can really be fierce. So that's in us when you start to cultivate, you know, that compassion energy in yourself. That's actually healing the disease of Watiko. Now, understand Watiko, it's also a collective psychosis. So it's operating through, you know, the whole species. It's not just something individually. It's something it's like a psychic epidemic that we're in the middle of, you know. But the important thing is that encoded in its virulence, in its venom, is an actual blessing. But we only can receive that blessing if we recognize what Watiko is showing to us. If we don't recognize what Watiko is showing to us, we will continue to be destroying the biosphere and ourselves. But if we have the recognition of what it's showing to us, then we actually evolve. And that's what this whole thing is about.
And I just wanted to add, your book has some of the best blurbs I've ever seen on a book ever. Sting, Tom Hartman, Brad Steiger, Carolyn Mice. I want to read Sting's blurb for your book really quick.
Sure.
No. But, I mean, come on, you can't get any better than that. So you have the best blurbs I've ever seen on a book, just about. You have some pretty good blurbs.
Well, thank you. It feels like I have a lot of support, a lot of really, you know, kind of influential people who are just really awake or are really, really supporting and wanting everybody to read the book. So I just appreciate that.
Definitely. And we're talking about Sting the musician, not some wrestler dude, the musician.
Right.
We were joking around in the chat, who's better, Bono or Sting, earlier. Somebody else was saying that, but I said they're both great, but I said Sting because he's in Dune.
Right, there you go.
They're both good, but that was just an inside joke earlier in the chat room. But here's this blurb on Paul's book, From Sting the Musician. This book brilliantly exposes how the very roots of the madness that is threatening life on Earth are ultimately to be found within our psyche. I love that Paul is taking seriously the profound implications of what it means that all of us are living in a mass shared dream. His startlingly clear premise challenges me to reflect upon both the world and myself in radically mind-altering ways. Something important is coming through his imagination-filled musings. Visionary insight into the intrinsic genius of our species feels inspired by a truly creative, compassionate, and enlivening spirit. I always look forward to reading Paul's work. It stimulates me to greater lucidity, disturbs me enough to awaken me out of my complacency, and encourages me to fly on the wings of the creative imagination. The world would be a better place if everyone read this book. His vision is a royal gift for all of us. It makes me want to sing. Bravo, Sting. That's just cool. Definitely.
Yeah, no, totally. I was blown away. I was blown away when he wrote that, and when he first got in touch with me a number of years ago, because, you know, I've been doing all these articles for years, and one day I woke up and there was in my inbox, in my email, there was this email from Sting just saying how he's like, you know, kind of a fan of my work, and I was blown away.
It's definitely a cool thing, no doubt about it. And so what about the shadow side? I'm a Capricorn, and it seems like they're one of the darker signs of the zodiac, and the whole thing with Capricorn is supposed to be you have this dark unconscious always pulling at you, and that's what I feel like. How do you integrate the shadow? I mean, what is the shadow exactly in your perspective?
Sure.
In that?
Sure, and that's a great question, because the shadow has everything to do with light, in the sense that, you know, you don't have light, you can't have a shadow. So the two really, you know, they go together. And the shadow is both the absence of light, but it also is an expression of the presence of light, that light is really nearby. And so when you think about just psychologically what the shadow is, it's the part of ourselves that we just don't like, and that we're, you know, we feel, you know, we just want to hide from people, and that, you know, we want to disassociate from. And, you know, keep in mind, it can also have a positive aspect. We can be split off from our genius and our good qualities too. But it's typically thought of as like having this real, like this negative energy. And the way you see this, it's important to understand the shadow. I go into it a lot in the book because from the psychological point of view, it's the dynamic that underlies the whole cultivation of Watiko. In the sense that if any one of us is not in touch with our own darkness, because we all have, we all interface with the whole, with the collective unconscious, which is a full spectrum of light and dark. And to the extent that any of us are not in touch with our own evil, with our own darkness, with our own shadow, what do? We split off from it, and it gets projected outside of us. And one way to understand this, just think about in a night dream, if you actually are disassociated from part of yourself and you split it off energetically in the night dream, what's going to happen? Into the night dream will come into the dream, you know, in embodied form, a figure who will be in, you know, kind of the representative of that split off shadow part. And then we have and that's what's happening in the waking dream. When we project a shadow, all of a sudden, just like a dream, we will then draw evidence to confirm to us that the evil is then outside of ourselves. And then as soon as then somebody will embody that darkness outside of ourselves, we then have evidence. We have the proof that, oh, well, the evil really is outside of ourselves, not in ourselves, because now there's somebody who's actually incarnating that evil. So then that even more entrenches us in the viewpoint that the evil is outside of ourselves, so we then even more have justification to project out the darkness outside of ourselves. And of course, the other person is projecting their shadow onto us. It's never a one-way process. But the point is that as we do that, as we project the shadow, what happens is that we literally become possessed by the very evil that we project. And then by trying to destroy the shadow as it appears in someone out there, we're actually enacting the very original process of trying to get rid of our own darkness. We're actually then enacting it in the outside world. And you see, that's Watiko. It's an inner disease of the soul that actually explicates itself through the outside world in a synchronistic way, as if this is a dream. And that's kind of why it's so important to see this being like a dream. When you begin to realize that, then you're cultivating that more expanded perspective in yourself. That's the very point of view that helps to dispel Watiko.
Wow. It's definitely fascinating. Let me see what our time is. I don't think we're going to take a break yet. Jerry, you got a question?
Yeah, actually, I guess it has to do with the, I guess, a little more elaboration on the shadow concept. So in that sense, like from what you're saying, does that mean, like, if there's that externalization, now is that a projection, or is that kind of like a sort of valid association or synchronization with that shadow aspect of the person?
Right. Well, that's a really good question, because when we project the shadow onto, like, say, some person, there's always a hook. You know, that it's like when you hang a coat, there has to be a hook for you to hang the coat. So if we project the shadow onto someone or some group of people or a nation, they actually, you know, always have even a little speck of them that in a way invokes that projection out of us. But keep in mind, it's always, like I was saying, it's never a one-way process. It's always like this reciprocal process, where at the same time that they're invoking us to project the shadow on them, we're doing the same thing to them, and then we both have evidence that the evil is outside of ourselves, which then protects us from actually coming to terms with the evil that's inside of ourselves. So on the one hand, it's not that we're not, like, potentially seeing something in the other person, but the point is that if this is a dream, what is a dream? But it's a projection of our own mind. It's our own energy appearing to us seemingly externalized. It's an actual reflection of our own psyche. So when you actually have lucidity, you discover, oh, wow, the psyche isn't just in my head, but I'm actually inside of my psyche right now, that all of this is psyche, you know? And so the point being is that I think serves us, as far as awakening, to have the recognition that whatever evil and darkness we're seeing in someone else is actually, you know, not separate. It's actually a reflection of that same evil in ourselves. And just one final point, you see, when we see evil in someone else, it's impossible to see evil, whether it's in the Taliban or in whoever, just fill in the blank. It's impossible to see evil without a similar evil energy getting ignited in our own psyche. In the same way that when we see the unconscious outside of ourselves, like if somebody's fully acting out the unconscious, it will trigger our own unconscious. It can't not. It's non-local. What's happening outside is coextensive with what's happening in our psyche. Same thing with evil. When we see it out there, it sets a flame and ignites a similar evil energy in our own selves. Even if we just become all self-righteous and filled with indignation, well, that's the disguised form of the evil operating in ourselves. The point being, instead of focusing on it outside of ourselves at that moment, if something in ourselves, in our psyche, is triggered, to put our attention on that inside of ourselves, because all of a sudden that's an incredible opportunity to add consciousness to what was previously unconscious in ourselves. And to the extent we're able to do that and to actually to metabolize what's gotten triggered in us, then when we assimilate that and integrate that, then we can actually, instead of unconsciously react to evil, we can consciously respond in a way that actually would be of benefit.
Yeah, definitely. And very intriguing subject, and I think the balancing of, you know, what a lot of people perceive as light and dark is really sort of the conundrum of the era, isn't it, really?
Yeah, totally. No, this is what we're dealing with. You know, in the Bible they call it powers and principalities. This isn't just a personal thing that we've all gotten kind of, you know, in a way, enlisted into a deeper cosmic, mythic, archetypal drama of the incarnation of the divine. And we're being demanded to come to terms with our own darkness.
So when it comes to evil, I know you just said principalities of darkness. I guess I have a trouble understanding exactly what evil is. Is it a being of sorts, like the devil, or is it, sometimes I wonder if it's just negative energy that people don't know how to handle it, and it overcomes them and it overtakes them. And then, of course, there's the Christian perspective that there's a cackling devil that, you know, every time something bad happens, they blame the devil, which kind of gets on my nerves. But I'm kind of confused exactly, too.
Sure. Sure.
I'd like to hear your perspective on exactly what you think evil is.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I talk about this in the book. You know, and just to remember, when you have a dream is like this multidimensional phenomena. So, you know, it has many different dimensions, and they can all be true simultaneously. And what I talk about in the book, I go, the real source of what we're calling evil. And keep in mind, you know, so much of the book is really mapping evil and illuminating it and describing it. But I go, source of it is basically, because I so inquire into what is the root, what is the absolute root of this whole phenomena. And what I've discovered is that it's exactly the same thing that, you know, the actual Buddha, this is actually exactly the same insight that the Buddha had, is that the source of evil is our own clinging and our own, you know, just this, you know, the clinging to that we exist as an egoic, isolated, alien entity, and that's separate from the universe, and that's a process that we're actually generating moment by moment. It's not something that happened a million years ago and we're just feeling the effects. It's something we're actually unwittingly participating in at this moment and this moment, to the extent that we're not fully awake. It is that, in a way, that contraction against our own infinite light. And so the fact that we're clinging to an identity that's imaginary and that's an illusion, that elaborates itself over all the dimensions of reality in such a way that it actually will invest in and manifest in what we're calling. Okay, and just to sort of put this in context, with my first book, where I, you know, it was called The Madness of George W. Bush, A Reflection of Our Collective Psychosis, and I had mentioned Watiko, but I didn't know much about the indigenous whole, like, mythology, so I just mentioned it, but I came up with a term which was really a synonym for Watiko, and it was my own term, and it was called malignant egophrenia, or ME disease, me disease. And what I talk about is that it's an actual misidentification of who we imagine we are. And that's what I'm talking about when I say the clinging and the grasping onto an imaginary self that doesn't exist in the way we imagine it does. In the same way, if we think the devil or Satan is an actual objectively existing entity, same thing, we're completely self-deceiving. We're under an illusion. We then were making something real, i.e. the devil, that actually, ultimately speaking, has no objective intrinsic existence. And what I'm pointing at, this is totally consistent with all the discoveries in quantum physics, where, you know, they talk about what is the nature of this reality? What is the nature, for example, of light? Oh, well, in certain circumstances, it manifests as a wave. In other circumstances, it manifests as a particle. It depends how you observe it. And from this point of view, it's called the observer effect in physics, that they say it makes no sense at all to talk about an objective universe separate from the observer, and it makes no sense at all to talk about an observer separate from the universe, that the observer is the observed. So anybody who's talking about the devil or Satan, that they objectively exist, no, that's completely, that's the illusion. That is to fall under the spell of Watiko, okay? And, okay. Yeah, I could say a lot about this. I mean.
Hey, Paul, we're going to take our break now, and I think that's a good stopping point. We can get back on the subject when we come back. But everybody, we'll be back in 8 to 10 minutes. You're listening to UFO Paranormal Radio Network, and we'll be right back with Paul Levy, and we'll be discussing Dispelling Watiko, Breaking the Curse of Evil. And, Paul, do you have a website or anything you want to plug?
Yeah, sure. The website where you can get the book, I'm selling autographed copies, I'm paying for shipping, and there's a ton of articles, that I've written over the years that are offered. It's awakeninthedream.com. So AWAKEN inthedream.com.
Okay, and it's an excellent book. It's definitely a unique book that everyone needs to read. We'll be right back with me and Jerry Avalos, and we'll be back in 8 to 10 minutes. See you in a bit with Paul.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows didn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everybody. This is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, the world needs to hear the truth.
I which was...
Welcome back to Church of Mavis Radio. Be sure you stop by churchofmavisradio.com and mingle. And also, we have a Facebook group, Church of Mavis Radio Show. And also, we're on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. You can get the ParanormalRadioNetwork.org to check out the archives. And my appearance on Mind Cemetery has been really good. Also, the Don Walton Show. That was a doozy. And stop by the site and mingle. There's plenty of things to look at. You can also access my examiner from the site up top. It says Florida Examiner, and I have a lot of, just interviewed Nick Redfern on Monster Diary there, and putting up an interview about ninjas this week, and there's a bunch of other ones. Also, Jim Mars, he's doing one. I have a lot I got to put up. I'm behind, so I have a whole bunch of stuff to put up on Examiner this month. But we're with our guest, Paul Levy, about Dispelling with Tico, Breaking the Curse of Evil, and we have Jerry Avalos with us. And one thing I wanted to ask you, Paul, what can you tell us about Jack D. Forbes? I noticed in the beginning it says he's an American Indian scholar, and it's kind of where I guess you found out about with Tico and a mentor and a teacher to you. He has a book called Columbus and Other Cannibals. That sounds intriguing. Check that out. And the title's kind of strange, Columbus and Other Cannibals, which we all know Columbus, there's a lot of controversy with that. But I kind of find the title kind of funny in an ironic kind of way, Columbus and Other Cannibals. So,
well, he was talking
Columbus a cannibal, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, well, he actually really introduced me to Watiko. You're right in that way, in that, you know, from his point of view as Native American, somebody like Christopher Columbus, who we tend to you know, create a whole, like, mythology around in a positive way, from the Native American point of view, he was an embodiment of Watiko disease, which is cannibal sickness. And so what Forbes did for me, which was incredibly helpful, was he actually read the Watiko mythology from a psychological point of view. So he wasn't just fixed in his perspective, seeing it like, oh, there's this Watiko monster that lives at the edge of the forest and eats people or possesses people. But he was actually understanding, oh, wow, it's actually symbolic and psychological in origin. And you know, so that book, I can't recommend that book enough. It's such a wonderful book. And as I was going through that book, it was just so inspiring me, just based on my own experience, that it was one of the major things that made me decide to write the book I did on dispelling Watiko.
Well, yeah, I definitely have to check that out. It sounds very, very interesting. No doubt about it. Anything else you want to add about evil? We kind of broke off there. You recall?
Yeah, well, there's so much. In the sense of one of the ways, you see, when we see evil out in the world, when we see Watiko, for example, the evil of Watiko, and if we fight against it, or if we get caught in polarization, in, oh, they have Watiko and we don't, that when we're investing in polarization, that's the signature of the disease, so that we're unwittingly feeding evil. So in the same way, if we fight against evil, we've already lost. So one of the things that Watiko teaches us is the way to defeat, quote-unquote, this thing called evil is to find the place in ourselves that's invulnerable to its effects. And that's the true nature. That's who we actually are. And when we find that, then, you know, just like you have a mirror and reflections in the mirror, but the reflections don't taint or stain the mirror, that whatever the evil that's manifesting, it's not, it doesn't affect us, it doesn't touch us, we don't get hooked by it. So that's one of the things, to find the part of us in a way that's not able to be taken over by evil, in the sense that it's, you know, you could call it the self, the true self, that's really the very thing, in a way, that's one of the forms of the blessing of evil, is that it can potentially really point us and connect us to who we actually are. And then when we really, like, you know, kind of connect in that way, then we're actually being really like these bodhisattvic agents in the world, where we're genuinely able to be of help.
Gotcha. And so in a sense, evil separation from the universe or God or creator or the spirit.
Or from each other, or from parts of ourselves, you know. So to the extent that if we think, you know, oh, like I was saying, they have Watiko and we don't, or you know, they're evil and we aren't, then we're unwittingly feeding the very evil we're fighting against. And for example, a lot of well-meaning political activists, they have the best of intention, they have good hearts, but if they're actually fighting the evil in the powers that be, and have hatred and anger and are reacting and are thinking the evil exists outside of ourselves, they don't realize that they're unwittingly at that moment being instruments for the very, very evil they're fighting against. You know, it's like, it's a form of trauma, because one of the things that trauma does, and, you know, Watiko is a form of trauma, is that when we suffer from trauma, the way we try to heal from trauma actually is the very thing that regenerates and recreates and perpetuates the very trauma we're trying to heal from in an infinitely self-perpetuating feedback loop. That's the nature of Watiko. And so to the extent that we don't see that, then we're, even though we, you know, could be like really well-intentioned people, we're unwittingly actually agents of the dark, you know. And you see, the thing about Watiko, it can, in a way, subsume anything, even the best intention thing. It can sort of co-opt it, in a way. That's a perfect word. It can co-opt even something that has the best of intentions to its nefarious agenda, and all based on, you know, through unconsciousness. You know, because now the thing about Watiko, and this is important to understand, is that it works through the projective tendencies of the mind. We're always projecting. I mean, this being a dream, is that, what is a dream but it's a projection? We're always projecting onto the waking inkblot. And one way to understand this, when we project onto the inkblot, it's not like we project in one moment and then 3 moments later the inkblot then shapeshifts to reflect back our projection. No, it's not like that at all. In the very moment we project, instantaneously, the inkblot has no choice but to spontaneously and reflect back the projection in no time whatsoever. So then we become entranced by the way the inkblot has then shapeshifted and is reflecting back our projection, and we then think that whatever we're projecting exists objectively separate from us, and we then react to it as if it's objective and separate from us, and that's unwittingly to be feeding Watiko. Okay, so it's, you see, the thing I'm trying to say is that it's really, really important in dealing, because the book is really like a book about how to dispel evil. And so I take this really seriously. And like one other way of understanding this, what Watiko is, it's a blindness. It's a form of psychic blindness that not only will it believe that it's sighted, but when we suffer from Watiko, we don't only believe that we're seeing clearly, we believe we're seeing more clearly than anyone else. So it's a sense of total being like under self-deception, or in a way we're deceiving ourselves, and then we're fooling ourselves into believing that we're not deceiving ourselves. We're like in denial, and then we're in denial that we're in denial. So if we were not, it would blow our denial. So it becomes a self-generating, in a way, you know, it develops an autonomy, like a seemingly autonomous life and will of its own, this thing called, you know, Watiko, that then what it'll do, it then assumes, like I was saying before, it assumes our form. It takes us over. It puts us on. And then we unwittingly identify with it, thinking that we're just acting on our own impulses when we've actually been duped. We're mimicking ourselves. We're impersonating ourselves. We're not being authentic. And all the while, we're being a vessel for this higher-dimensional, invisible, formless bug of Watiko, particularly its evil aspect, to then act itself out through us. And all the while, we're thinking that we're acting for the good of other people. It's insanity. That's what Watiko is. It's a collective psychosis, and it's actually not a theory. It's what's playing out in the world today.
I know everybody deals with it on some level, but it seems like it's made a nest in politics. Is that more so than other places?
Yeah, that's definitely true. Because people, you see, do you remember what I was saying, that the way that Watiko, its origin is inside the human psyche, but the psyche is non-local, so it elaborates itself through the medium of the outside world, and people who actually are susceptible to Watiko are very much attracted to power. So they, you know, there's a real draw to, you know, when there's positions of power, that they tend to draw people who are influenced and in a way taken over by and informed by Watiko. And so that's absolutely true. And that's why, you know, the idea of trying to like make the world better through political means, well, I would just point out that our political system right now in the United States has become so corrupted. And that's kind of why I'm in the book, I point that it's only through individuals, and I'm not the only one saying this, a lot of people way smarter than me have said this for centuries, that it's through any one individual that, you know, actually begins to wake up and really expand their awareness, that has an energetic effect on the entire field, on the entire collective unconscious. And then what happens when a sufficient number of people actually, you know, begin to, and one way of understanding this, a beautiful image, is when you take like these grains of sugar and you just have a glass of water and you'll just take the sugar and just they'll dissolve. As you pour each granule of sugar into the water, it'll just dissolve and dissolve. And then you add one more, you know, one more like of the grains of sugar when it reaches the saturation point, and you add that one more grain and all of a sudden the crystal will materialize. And same thing, any one of us in this moment, having the recognition of the dreamlike nature or owning our shadow or seeing Watiko or waking up, any one of us at any moment doing that might be the grain of sugar that crystallizes a change in the entire collective unconscious of our species. You know, so that's what I'm pointing at.
All right, Jerry, you there?
Yeah, I'm actually... It kind of got me curious because in a lot of ways there seems to be some kind of or implied information exchange and almost telepathic nature, if you will. It seems it's being implied here. And then considering we're talking about if life is a shared dream, would you say that this can be kind of transferred in a sense too? Like without knowing it, can you kind of transfer this sort of mind frame to someone else without realizing it?
That's absolutely true. In other words, the thing about Watiko, it's a contagious disease of the mind. And so, you know, one way to understand the collective psychosis that's happening in our country right now and in the world is that in a way there's a war going on, but it's not the war we think that's happening, but it's a war on consciousness. And one of the ways of understanding this, so on the one hand, there's the mainstream media, which is in a way the propaganda organ of Watiko. And what will happen, and particularly because I so appreciated your pointing out that there's some sort of mind transmission or telepathic goings on between us, because our psyches are really permeable and influence each other. You know, we're all very, very sensitive. And what will happen when somebody... Keep in mind, with Watiko, there are all these, like, sort of, whatever, like, you know, sort of degrees of being a... But when somebody's, like, fully taken over in a given moment, they've stepped out of just being like this human being in a certain way, and they've, in a way, tapped into the archetypal, the transpersonal, which is a dimension that is, you could think of it as a higher dimension than the third dimension, than our personal reality. But by doing that, they actually access a certain charisma, or like this charm or this magnetism, because they've identified and plugged in and are accessing this archetypal evil that can then inform them and can then, you know, flow through them. And because of that charisma, they can easily, you know, in, and think about just politicians when they do that. They can have, like, Hitler being an example. He was taken over by something that was beyond himself, and take a look at the effect he had on the unconscious of his followers. And so then they, the people who follow the person so possessed, will in a sense get entrained or entranced under that person's archetypal spin, because their unconscious part will actually, in a way, hook their followers' unconscious parts, and they then, in a sense, reinforce each other part of the psyche that's mad. And they actually, it's like a form of like this group, sort of like this, this narcissistic bubble gets conjured up around the people who get into alignment in a certain way, and they're all reinforcing and supporting and feeding off of and into each other's madness. And then any reflection from outside of the system of the insanity of what they're doing, any sort of evidence or facts or any sort of reflection, then the people, the messengers of that reflection, get demonized, and they are seen as the ones who are crazy, and they are seen as the ones who are evil. And what I'm describing is basically the way a collective psychosis works. And what I'm describing is actually what's happening in our greater body politic. And so that's why it's important to understand how Watiko works, both individually in ourselves, and how it actually operates collectively through our interactions and transactions with each other, that it actually will operate in a collective way through all of our members, you know. And so that's kind of why in the book I'm really trying as best as I can, from as many to view as I can imagine, to articulate the way Watiko works.
Definitely is an intriguing subject. I mean, I think everyone recognizes that in popular society that there needs to be some kind of change from this selfish perspective. Now, in terms of your research, was there a time where maybe this wasn't as pervasive? And if there was, like, when did it seem to start amping up?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I actually go into that, like, what is the history of Watiko? Did it just, from one point of view, it's been going on for thousands of years, you know, and because it's at the bottom of, in a way, of all of the violence and the inhumanity that our species has enacted on each other and ourselves. And from another point of view, it seems like we're approaching an event horizon, in the sense that the brutality and the inhumanity and the evil, it's very much like the evil has come out from hiding, and it's no longer in the shadow or in the corner hiding, but it's totally visible for anybody who has opened their eyes and will look. And that's very different, even politically, the way, you know, maybe a number of decades ago, yeah, there would be, you know, this evil that would get, you know, sort of enacted politically, but there would, the people who were the actors were trying to cover it up and hide it. When it's not even that way anymore. Now it's like it doesn't even make a difference if the politicians are openly acting out, you know, evil. They don't care. So it's kind of interesting how it's very much like that. This evil is becoming more and more apparent, and that's, from the dreaming point of view, that's an expression that, well, like I was saying before, there's a correlation between darkness and light. So that's actually an expression, like when you know, it's like, for example, in one person's personal psychological process, if they're having dreams that these evil energies are becoming more and more manifest and more they're able to see them, that's an expression that energy, that evil is actually potentially available for being assimilated into the wholeness of their psyche. So it's potentially this sign But it all depends, I go back to this again and again, if we recognize what is actually being shown to us. You know, but if we think of the evil as out there, separate from us, then we're unwittingly just, we're complicit. We're actually totally colluding with the very evil that we're fighting against then.
I'm kind of curious, what do you mean by, in the archetypal psychohistory chapter, you talk about the archetype of the apocalypse. You know how people, different religions and Christianity especially, and I'm sure the Muslim religion, or you know, they all want this apocalypse to happen. They're manifesting it on some level, and if it wasn't for these manifestations or whatever, it probably wouldn't happen. Kind of like they're creating it. That's part of Wetiko as well, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely. I mean, people, for example, of like fundamentalists on the religious right who are expecting the end times, and you know, and if they're in positions of power, they're actually then they're creating this incredible violence, which then they will cite as evidence proving that their prophecy is coming true, not realizing the role that they're playing. It's total insanity, and it's completely Wetiko. And just to say a few words about that chapter, about the apocalypse, because it's a way of contextualizing and understanding the Wetiko epidemic, because the apocalypse, etymologically, the word means when something hidden is actually being shown, and all of a sudden, you know, we're beginning to see it. So something that was in the dark actually coming to the light. That's one way of understanding what the word apocalypse means. But psychologically, so on the spiritual level, it means the coming of the Messiah. But psychologically, it's the coming into the conscious realization of the self, of the wholeness of our personality. And so what I point at in the book is that unlike 2000, you know, like when the time of Christ, when, you know, here God was incarnating through one human being, and he was just a pure instrument of the light. And when you see it symbolically, then here was Satan, who was totally embodying the dark. It was like the dark and the light, seen as a dream, were totally split and polarized, and Christ was just totally the vehicle of nothing but light. Well, what you discover is that, well, that whole deeper process of the incarnation of God is still happening, and it's happening right now, not just through one human being like it did through Christ, but it's happening now through all of humanity, through all of us. That this is alchemy, you know, the alchemical, the alchemists really discovered that we, as these people, as human egos, play a key, crucial, participatory role in the incarnation of the deity. But unlike Christ, we are tainted with a shadow. We're not just these pure light, you know, these vessels. But so here, this, you could say God is incarnating not just through one man, but through all of humanity. And as God gets closer to incarnating in and through the human ego, through our species, more and more what we're having to deal with is the confrontation with the evil that's inside of us. And that's a way of contextualizing and understanding what Wetiko is, in the sense that, yeah, there's a deeper process where the universe is dreaming itself awake. It's waking itself up through us. We're discovering that we are the Messiah, that if we think, oh, the Messiah is something outside of ourselves, some off-planet deity is going to come and save us, we're completely deluded. That's total insanity. What even Christ himself in the apocryphal text was teaching. He was, see what's happening symbolically. You know, there's a famous quote of John in the apocryphal text that he says something like, I am convinced that God gave this dispensation to see all things symbolically, and symbols are the language of dreams. You know, that symbol is reflecting back to us a deeper something that lies in ourselves. And when we begin to see that, and a perfect example of a symbol is Christ. Christ is a living symbol of our wholeness, you know. So I can go on forever about this, but if you have a particular question, I can...
Yeah, I just came across a paragraph that kind of glowed for me to read from your book, and it's on it's in the Vampires, Parasites, and Aliens, and it's about the ET UFO phenomenon, And also, I want to tell, I'm kind of wondering about this term archons lately. And Tessa B. Dick, Philip K. Dick's, well, when he was alive, she was married to him. But she's going to get into that in her book. But with the, I'll read the chapter and then see what you have to say about it from the perspective. Interestingly, such disparate thinkers as Jung and ethnobotanist Terence McKenna hypothesized that the ET UFO phenomenon might actually be an extension of the psychic fact that we have become so split off from our true self that we can only begin to experience it in the projected form of an alien other. Are the seeming appearances of ET UFOs in the outer world simply an embodied reflection of this inner psychic process, as if an archetypal process deep within the human psyche is being dreamed up into materializing itself through our universe in order to show us something about ourselves? And then, of course, you get into the archons and stuff like that. But I've had UFO and alien experiences in my younger years when I was playing around with the occult. We talk about that subject all the time. But that paragraph, to me, was fascinating. I'd like to hear a little bit more on that, what you think about that.
Sure. No, and I appreciate that, because what that's pointing at is that they're you know, what they wonder about is, are we so split off from who we are and from the self, from the true self, that we can only experience it as in an extreme form in projection as some form of alien other? And when you see, and one way to understand this is that when you see this reality as a dream, well, when we're split off, when I project out, when I'm disassociated from a part of myself in a dream, what happens? I project it outside and it appears as something external to myself. But it's actually that it's an actual reflection of something in me that's appearing as some form of other. And so that's really the point of view of, like, wow, this being some sort of a dream, and then something, the phenomena such as, like, you know, a UFO or an ET might actually be, ultimately speaking, a reflection of ourself, of the part of us that we're so completely split off from that we can only experience it as some form of alien or some form of other. But it's actually, ultimately speaking, you know, who we are. And we just need to, you know, to wake up to that and to integrate that.
Very interesting. And, you know, there's all kinds of theories about extraterrestrials as far as, I mean, it could be different levels. Some of them could be that. Some of them could be from another dimension. Some of them could be a multidimensional self of us, which kind of feeds into that that paragraph. And it's a very unique perspective, a way to look at it. And it kind of makes sense to me, definitely. I've had a lot of UFO encounters all my life, and even up to this day. And I've even seen some strange beings. I've seen beings that are very light-like, like made out of like luminous beings, just pure light. I've seen beings that are very serpentine or reptilian-like. Once I saw some little beings that were in cloaks, they looked like Jawas from Star Wars, standing around a black box in the woods with a friend of mine. That was in my earlier years. I haven't seen any beings in a while, but I do see UFOs and stuff like that, but that's definitely a unique perspective, and I've, you know, studied a lot of Terence McKenna, so I thought that was fascinating, definitely. Oh, yeah, the other thing is, what do you think about the Archon situation? What is that exactly? I hear everybody talking about Archons lately. What exactly is an Archon?
Yeah, well, the Archons, that's like, you know, the Gnostics, they talk about the Archons, and it's very much the same thing as Watiko. And so, you know, when I, you know, in the book, I, because it's, the book isn't about Archons, it's about Watiko, but I mention the Archons, and I really say, yeah, there, it's really, this is just what the Gnostics would call Watiko, you know. And yeah, so it's really the same.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, just, well, one other thing about the Archons is that, you know, they talk about it, that they, the Archons intrude themselves, they insinuate themselves into our mind, in a sense where they make, like Castaneda talks about, you know, has Don Juan talk about these, you know, the flyers or something really related to Watiko and the archons that I talk about. And he has Don Juan call them a foreign installation. It's almost like a space station that's inside of our mind, where there's this alien entity that in a way is assuming our seat, and then we just identify with it, and you know, and then it more and more in a certain way will inspire us to compulsively act it out, to the point where like more and more we just get taken over by it. You know, and I describe this process in detail, and that's really the way Watiko will in a way colonize the psyche. Or the archons, same thing. They just, you know, will literally take over one's mind, and they're continually, like at every moment, they're absolutely terrified of that their ploy will be found out. And that's the perfect, like, an expression of how the Watiko germ in our psyche is absolutely terrified of being seen, of how it works, because when you see it, you take away its food. And then it can't live. Then it just dies. It just, you know, because ultimately it has no intrinsic independent existence separate from us. You know, in the same way that if with a vampire, you know, there's no such thing as a vampire in and of itself. It has to feed off of something, right? And if there's no feeding station, then it just dies. It just, you know, because ultimately it has no objective intrinsic existence. It only exists, you know, compared in a relationship to a figure who it can siphon energy as its fuel. Same thing with Watiko.
Well, once you discover the antidote to it and, you know, break the curse, so to speak, it's kind of like an addiction, isn't it? Trying to come back and, you know, get back in and then get back inside you. It's kind of like a constant thing, right? You got to deal with all throughout life or so. Just getting rid of it forever. Is there like, no, is that like Nirvana? It's always going to try to come back and like the little imp, right? And jump back in.
Yeah, no, that's a great image, because, you know, that's where one of the most important things is to develop a sense of like sort of having, you know, kind of this mindfulness, which in a way is this having this guardian at the gate of your psyche. And, you know, that also cultivates a sense of real humbleness, because we realize, wow, until I become fully and utterly and totally enlightened in who is, then at any moment I can fall prey and act out my unconscious in a way that's hurtful to myself or to others. And that's to fall under the thrall of Watiko. And so, you know, one develops a real, like, the humbleness, the humility, and the mindfulness. But what happens is that more and more and more you stabilize and you more and more connect with that part of you, like I was talking before, the self or the true nature, who you really are. And as that identity gets more and more like stabilized and present, then the power and energy of, you know, that addictive energy of Watiko just more and more becomes smaller and smaller and more impotent.
Definitely, and I see what you're saying. It is kind of like an imp, and you have to, you know, it's kind of come back. And I guess the more you're aware of it, you can be like, "Oh, that's the Watiko trying to get back inside of me." I was looking at some of the Buddhism stuff. I didn't realize Buddhism had like a dark lord. What was his name?
That's exactly it. That's the analog to Watiko. And when Buddha became enlightened, he even, like, there was, like, the evil one, you know, Mara, who would absolutely, you know, exclaim in just horror that, oh, my God, you know, the exalted one, the Buddha sees me, I have no power. Because whenever part of the Buddha's, like, an intrinsic part of the Buddha's enlightenment was he was switched on to Watiko. He saw Mara. He saw the evil one and how it operated, and thereby, by seeing it in the same way, just in the mythology of, like, vampires, when the light of the sun, when dawn comes, the vampire has no power. You know, that's symbolic. Same thing with Mara for the Buddha, or Watiko with us. When we see it, you know, it absolutely, you take away its autonomy and you take away its omnipotence. It has no power then. That's kind of why, that's why I've written the book, is to try to just point out again and again, to name it, to show its attributes, to show how it works, to create the map for it. You know, it's like that dream I was sharing where I was seeing the vampire and I was trying to let other people know, but other people couldn't see it. Well, over the course of my life, I've developed the language and the fluency to point out the vampire in a way that more and more people are actually seeing what I'm pointing out, and it's really, really helping people. All I want is for people to read the book, because I think it's really, you know, people who have read it, it's changed their life. I mean, it's just been really, really beneficial for people.
Definitely. You've exposed Wetiko, no doubt about it. We got about 10 or 15 minutes. Jerry, you got anything to add?
Yeah, actually, I was wondering if there's like any kind of, I don't know, mantras or meditation techniques that might help keep one grounded or centered in relation to not going too far either way in the spectrum related to this?
Yeah, I that's actually a really good question. And I hesitate to just because I do Tibetan Buddhist practice, and there are particular, you know, I was saying before, like there's the mantra of compassion, Om Mani Padme Hung. You know, but honestly, I'm just hesitant to tell people you should do this particular practice, because what I would say is that any practice that brings inspiration and that connects you with your heart and cultivates a sense of compassion and a sense of that, you know, this is a dream. In other words, that this is not separate world we live in. It's not separate from our own mind. That it is, that we are in our own psyche. Any practice that in a sense, you know, grounds us and connects us to those realizations and, you know, particularly to the heart, because it's not just a mind thing, it's having to do with really feeling that compassion and that love, that's really, really helpful. Combined with, now, the thing about Wetiko, it's this daimonic energy, and the word daimon is very, very interesting, because etymologically the word daimon, it means the inner voice or the guiding spirit, and it's related to the word genie, as in I dream of genie, and genius, which is related to the word vocation and calling and hearing a voice. The point is so here Wetiko is a daimonic energy, and a daimonic energy can literally possess a person so that they become the instrument to incarnate the daimonic energy. Now the point is that encoded in the daimonic energy of Wetiko is the creative spirit. Okay, and so if we connect, if we access that daimonic energy, we with consciousness, we will actually access the our own creativity, and we then, in a way, like an artist, and not necessarily just painting or drawing, that's too much of like this flatland version of what an artist is, but in a sense of being like this multidimensional artist, and the canvas is this universe, and to the extent that we connect with that creative spirit. And we access, you know, consciously that daimonic energy, we then will find our genie, our genius, our vocation, our calling, we'll hear our inner voice, our guiding spirit, and we'll actually, you know, be healed from Wetiko. But here's the rub. If we turn away from that daimon, from that inner voice, from that guiding spirit, if we don't listen to it, if we don't honor it, that daimon becomes a demon, okay? And that's one of the ways of understanding Wetiko. Like the indigenous people, they would call demons what psychologists now call autonomous complexes, which is what Wetiko is. And an autonomous complex is a split-off part of the psyche that develops a seemingly almost like quasi-will or life of its own. So I would say, to answer your question, anything that connects you with yourself, that, you know, cultivates compassion and will allow you to express your creative whatever medium, all of that in a way is our responsibility and will actually really, really help to dispel any of the negative effects of the evil of Wetiko.
Cool. So would you say that following one's inspiration would be another way to do that?
Absolutely. I have a term, but we can conspire to co-inspire each other, that there's a way of us hanging out where we can actually help each other to deepen our inspiration. So anything
that actually is, you know, in any way interesting or intuitively just inspiring, you know, I mean, that's how I found what I do now. I was in such deep suffering that I any time I found a thread of anything that seemed interesting to me or that, you know, made me feel inspired, I would just follow it and follow it. And we're talking then over the course of a number of years, I found myself and I found my work. And so that's really the way, is just to really follow whatever, you know, brings you joy and brings you inspiration, for sure.
Very cool.
It's definitely inspiring me. The book's great, and the show is just healing in itself on many levels, and a lot of great positive feedback in the chat room, and it's definitely something special, no doubt about it. And I'm someone that I relate a lot to going through a lot of suffering, and definitely always looking for a cure, and I definitely think your book is a part of that. It's great. Great. I can't recommend it enough for everybody to read it and check it out. It's a journey in itself. Just to read it is healing on many levels. Definitely great. And what are some of your other books? You said The Madness of George Bush.
That was the first one, The Madness of George Bush, reflection of our collective psychosis. And that was, it's basically about what Tico. And why I wrote that book was because when Bush became president, I was so disturbed by what he was doing and by who he was, and I was realizing, oh, my God, he's like the incarnation of this non-local psycho-spiritual disease of the soul, which, you know, I'm now calling Watiko. I was, oh, my God, he's like, you know, he's the, like Christ was the incarnation of the Word or of the light in human form.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, well, you take a photograph and you take the negative. Here Bush was like the opposite of that. He was the incarnation of, in a way, this evil energy. And I was realizing, oh, my God, he could never play out what he played out without his supporters and followers. And I was realizing, oh, my God, it's a non-local field, like that evil couldn't play itself out just through one person. I mean, it could in a limited way, but it could only play itself out with, you know, in such a collective, powerful form where people, even well-intentioned, good people who were supporting Bush, it's an example of they were non-locally being agents of Watiko, and even though they might have had good intentions. And so that was really my first book. And then I wrote, you know, my second book, that was the one about Watiko. It was just a self-published book. And it was just three articles, but the three articles that I wrote about Watiko, I actually wrote saying, I feel that this is the most important stuff I've ever written, because I've written a lot of articles. And my plan was to send out the book, you know, my self-published book on Watiko to, you know, to publishers, a letter asking them to publish it. I didn't even have to do that. Within a few weeks of the book coming out, the president of the publisher that published this book, you know, got in touch with me and said, oh, we came across your book. We feel it's so important. We want you to sign a contract. So I did. And then I had 5 months to get them the manuscript. And I just saw it as an opportunity. So I wrote and wrote and wrote every day. I would go to a cafe in the morning, have my Americano, and spend 3-4 hours just writing every day. I didn't miss one day. And that's where I have the new book. And it's, you know, it's, I think, 376 pages. So it's four times as much material as the original Watiko book, because I just really saw it as, oh, my God, I have this opportunity to get out, to really unfold my contemplation and inquiry into the nature of evil in a way that can really potentially be helpful for people. So that's what I've done. So, and I feel with this book that it's really one of the reasons I'm incarnate on this planet, is to have written this book. It just feels so profoundly important for me, you know, just in my own process, to actually have authored it.
Yeah, it came to mind about Hunter S. Thompson's Chief, and I think that was right after he found out Bush became president, which I like Hunter S. Thompson, but I know he dealt with Watiko, no doubt about it. But,
oh, totally, yeah.
You know, right after Bush was elected, I'm pretty sure. Not to look at it, but that's definitely a great writer that I miss. But, yeah, that's the point I'm at right now.
I'm published in magazines. I just got published in New Dawn magazine regularly, and I'm in 4 books. My interviews are, by the end of this 2013, I'll be in 4 books from different authors using my interviews. But the point I'm at right now is I'm trying to write my own book. And I've been talking about writing my own book for, like, my God, probably over 10 years. So there's, like, this resistance. It's like a battle. Or maybe that's what Tico, on some level, too, is overcoming that. And actually, I write every day, but it's just I haven't wrote my own book. So I'm kind of in some weird battle where I got to do it this year. It's like I'm in pain. It's like if I don't do it, the pain grows.
Right. Well, if I could just say, when the thing for me, when I was writing my book and you were talking every day, you know, it was the main thing I was doing every single day. It was, you know, and I totally relate just as an artist, as a creative person, to that resistance that you're talking about. And that it's not necessarily Watiko, but it can be if we actually, you know, kind of subscribe to it in a certain way where it stops us from creatively expressing ourselves. But the point I want to make is that there's something about when we actually, you know, tap in, it's like striking oil, we tap into that creative energy. When I do that, and I think this is true for everyone, it's the points in my life when I feel most alive and most awake and most healed.
Cool. That's definitely an expressing your soul and creating, no doubt about it.
Yeah,
and that's
totally.
Like what they, like, I write every day. It's just getting to that point of the book and all that. It's just, there's definitely some obstacles to overcome, but I'm going to do it. It's just battering them down. There's a resistance, and I guess once you break through the resistance, it gets easier.
Mm-hmm.
So, we got about, I think, like, 5 minutes. You got any future books you're working on or anything in the future?
Yeah, you know, I have some holes that are all having to do with what we've been talking about today that I've already written. And, you know, my plan was I was just going to compile a dozen of them, for example, or maybe 15 or 10 or whatever, and just come out with another book, you know, that would already be out right now. But I've just been so busy this whole year with getting this book out. But the point being that I have, like, a ton of other articles, and all I need to do is just to put them together and write an introduction. And then, you know, then I can, whether it be to self-publish it or, you know, I think now I can easily get a publisher if I wanted for the next book. But right now my whole focus is on getting the word out about this book because, you know, what I'm trying to do is to bring the word Watiko in to actually, you know, it has to do with finding the name, the profundity of when you find the name of a demon, it takes away its power. So I really want to introduce the word Watiko into our vocabulary to the point where more and more people, you know, really understand the meaning of what it's pointing at. And, you know, because it's as it gets more and more, like, into, you know, speaking it and into our language, it's going to create a net that's going to catch Watiko in a way that's going to take away its negative power. So I'm just really focusing right now on, you know, trying to get the word out
of
the book. Yeah, because all I want, it's not anything to do with money, I just want people to read the book because it felt like something came through me, like I caught something in the book, like I really captured something. And, you know, and I'm not just theorizing this, like when people who have read the book, I mean, they're saying to me, oh my God, it's just like, you know, it's really helping and changing, you know, their inner understanding in a way that's very, very helpful for them. So all I want is just for people to read the book.
So Watiko is the Cree, from the Cree language, right?
Right, right. It's Cree, and it also has to do with the Algonquin language, but Watiko, you know, is a little bit different than, you know, Wendigo. The Cree is particularly, the Watiko is particularly Cree. The Cree.
And Wendigo, what tribe is that from? It's the same thing, I mean, the same meaning, right? It's,
you know, yeah, that might be the Ojibwe, I'm not quite sure.
I have that down here somewhere. Wait, I thought I did. It's definitely no, I don't have that, but I know it's a different tribe. I just don't remember which one. I read it earlier, but it means
right.
The same thing. It's just different pronunciation.
Yeah, yeah, just a different translation, for sure.
Well, they've definitely given new insight on the beings. Most people look at it as a cryptozoology thing or a paranormal thing with the creature and everything, but you've taken it to a whole new level of awareness.
Well, the thing with it, if I can just say one thing, it's something that every one of us experiences in our life. I mean, we all can relate when you really, like, you know, see what I'm pointing at. There's not one person who doesn't have, like, you know, overwhelming experience of Watiko in their lives, whether it be in themselves or in their relationships or, you know, in the greater body politic. So it's something that we all experience. And all that I'm trying to do is, like, you know, create the language so that we can see it.
Is it similar to the trickster energy, sort of?
Oh, totally. It's totally tricksterish. And actually, a lot in the book I talk about in alchemy, there's, you know, the deity of alchemy is Hermes, and then also Mercurius, which, and the thing with like, you know, the mercurial energy is that it is a trickster, and in alchemy the Mercurius energy, Hermes Mercury, is a combination of the highest divinity of the Godhead itself, and it's found in the sewers. It's the deepest evil and the highest God co-joined in one phenomena. That's the God of alchemy, and that's a description of Watiko. That is the deepest evil.
Coyote, I love those stories and all that stuff from Native
American. Yeah, it's totally Coyote, and that's Watiko. It's totally a tricksterous, like a mercurial Coyote energy that combines both the opposites. And one final thing is that when you realize, wow, the opposites begin to become indistinguishable when they merge. When, like, for example, is Watiko the deepest, darkest evil? Well, it's actually helping us to wake up. Wow, maybe, you know, all of a sudden the difference between good and evil becomes indistinguishable. It's called the coincidentia opos ho incidence of opposites. When you actually get to that place in yourself where the opposites become united, that's the wholeness of the self. That's the true nature, and that's the place in ourselves that we're invulnerable to Watiko. And it's Watiko that introduced us to that. So you see, it's really, yeah, it's just an amazing thing when you inquire into it.
All right, Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. If you could give us your link one more time.
Sure, thank you. And it's actually AWAKEN in the dream. AwakenInTheDream.com. And you know, and on that site, there's my book. I'm sending out autographed copies. I'm paying for shipping, and there's a ton of articles all about this stuff for free if you don't want to buy the book. So it's all there. And then there's a ton of other audio interviews, and this one will be up there too that you can listen to.
Yeah, I'll send you the link to it. And also the publisher's North Atlantic Books. You can go to NorthAtlanticBooks.com and check out their other fine publications. They have some books also. I'm trying to get Michael Harner on the show. He has a new book that he wrote, The Way of the Shaman. I'm hoping to God get him on the show in April. That'd be awesome.
Wow,
but,
that's cool.
Yeah, that would be great. I don't know if it's... I'm working with Nick on that one. We'll see what happens. But
it's
been an absolute pleasure, Paul. And Jerry, you finale and drop some links there, and we'll end this puppy.
All right, cool. Well, yeah, thanks for having me on again. Paul, is awesome talking to you. It was a great subject, and I think it's cool that you're doing your work and bringing more awareness to that. And speaking of bringing more awareness, head over to universaltruthevolution.com for myself and my partner Tommy Hansen's endeavors over there with bringing together all kinds of alternative media. Going to be over in the LAX Hilton this next weekend pretty soon, so we'll hang out with myself and Stephen D. Kelly, Whistleblower, and, you know, Thunder Wyckoff. Some interesting people over there. I have some groovy products, too. So if you're in the LA area, feel free to drop by, say hi. And once again, thanks again, Jeff and Paul. It's a really cool show.
All righty, everybody.
Yeah, it's just
thanks
my pleasure, guys. I want to thank you so much. Totally. It's totally my pleasure. So thank you.
Yeah.
Loved it. Thanks, Paul. And everybody have a good weekend. Stop by churchofmavisradio.com and mingle. And we'll see you next Saturday with Tessa B. Dick and Michael Jagger's about The Walking Dead. And he'll be helping out co-host and tell us some story and out with the Walking Dead cast, which will be cool, from the show on AMC. Everybody have a good weekend, and thanks for listening. Take care. Good night.
Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with your host Alejandro Rojas.